Pickaxe.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome back to The Review of Death. I'm Matt, and I'm joined by Billy. Hello, Billy.
Hello.
How are you doing? You all right?
I'm all right. We should explain that we're not in our lovely, cosy office.
No.
People may have already been able to tell over audio, but you can certainly see it.
You've got four men with you on your end.
I've got four men on my end. That's quite right, Matthew. That it's already descended into smut. Excellent.
We're not in the studio because I have come into contact with someone who has COVID-19 and potentially have it myself. So we can't use the studio for this episode and probably not next week's episode either. Yes, we're going to be recording from home. So hopefully the sound quality won't be too bad and, you know, it should be all good. Today we're going to be talking about the most recent episode of Flux, Chapter 4, The Village of the Angels, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Did you enjoy it, Billy?
I enjoyed it an awful, awful lot, yes.
It was excellent. I thoroughly enjoyed it. But before we get into that, there's been a few bits of news over the past week. It was Doctor Who Day yesterday, as of recording this. It was the 23rd of November. 58 years of Doctor Who.
It feels like 57. It was a good day. We were just sort of talking about, you know, what had come out, and I don't think we were expecting much, really.
I wasn't expecting anything. I just thought that we might just get a few things on the BBC Twitter saying, oh, happy whatever, and then we got that little tribute video, and I thought, oh, that's it, that's all we're gonna get. So it was a surprise when we had two announcements.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I think it kind of sets a tone for future Doctor Who days that we kind of would expect an announcement, you know, for that sort of thing. But yeah, so we obviously find out that the next Doctor Who animation is going to be The Abominable Snowmen, the worst kept secret in history.
Yeah.
But that was very exciting. And the animation, I thought, looked fantastic. It was like, it's the same sort of Fury from the Deep type thing, but it looks like they've got a lot more money on this one. It looks brilliant.
Really good quality. I was really impressed. And like a proper trailer, because in the past we've sort of got like a shot of something with a bit of radiophonic sound over the back. So to actually see it properly and actually see some proper movement and stuff, it looked really, really great. And
I think they did a good job showing off the best bits of the animation.
Like, yes.
You know, this is how far this one has been able to come along. Like even the shot of the Doctor kneeling was like, I for some reason can't imagine the other animations being able to achieve that.
Yeah.
Even the ones that have come out in the last like 2 years. So that was really, really cool to see. So we got that announcement, and then of course we got a little teaser image for the festive New Year's special, which is going to be called Storage Unit of the Daleks or something like that, according to the little synopsis that was posted on the BBC Press Centre. And a cool promo image of the TARDIS with all those scratches. Yeah. What do you think that's all?
Well, it would seem that the stuff from Flux that's happening to the TARDIS is going to keep on going, because I assumed that it'll be fixed by the end of the series, but clearly not. Or clearly whatever happens in the finale of Flux has taken its toll even more on the TARDIS than what we've seen before. Or perhaps it's not. Perhaps this isn't a Flux thing, what's happening to the TARDIS. Perhaps this is something else again, and that's going to lead into further episodes in 2022. But yeah, there's some good guest stars in it. We've got Aisling Bea and Wassa Chops, Mrs. Doyle. I don't know her in real name, so I'm just going to say Mrs. Doyle's in Doctor Who, which is quite remarkable. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that. Nothing said about Daleks. Nothing said about the main characters either. Obviously, they've kept everything very quiet because they don't want to spoil Flux.
I think that's for the best. I mean, I think we can probably assume from promo photos that have come out that it's going to be the Doctor, Yaz and Dan.
Yeah.
But, you know, nothing's ever guaranteed, obviously, on Doctor Who. The Infinity symbol was an interesting thing that cropped up. Obviously, it's formed out of the 2020. And then they used an Infinity emoji on the posts. Infinity of the Daleks? I don't know. Sounds like a cool title.
Yeah, whatever that would mean.
It doesn't need to mean anything. What does revelation of the Daleks mean in the context of the story? Nothing.
Something is revealed. What's revealed in Revelation of the Daleks? Davros.
The great healer is Davros.
Yeah.
Whoa, what?
Yeah.
That's crazy. It doesn't look like his head in a jar or anything. That's mad. that's really exciting. But before we even get anywhere near there, we've still got to finish Flux. And we got one step closer on Sunday night with Village of the Angels. I was a bit scattergun in my approach of watching it. I was filming on the Monday on location. So I only managed to watch the first half an hour. Then I had to go downstairs for dinner. And then after dinner, I came back upstairs and watched the last, whatever it was, 20 or 30 minutes of the episode on my phone. So
I thought you would have had like a communal watch of the episode.
No, it didn't happen.
And is that what you hoped was going
to
happen?
I was like, how are we all not going upstairs immediately to watch it in someone's room? Why are we waiting until like 8 o'clock to have dinner? But it was not the best viewing experience watching it on my phone in a Premiere Inn.
Oh no, on your phone. Oh gosh. Can you get it on the telly?
I got the first half an hour on the telly.
Right.
But obviously the telly doesn't have iPlayer in the Premiere Inn, so that was a bit of a bummer. But I've got to say, I thought it was very, very good.
It was. But, I mean, I think it was probably maybe the best episode of this series so far.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the Santorum one was excellent as well, and I really enjoyed that. But I think maybe this one just overtakes it ever so slightly.
Yeah, I think that it, you know, we kind of mentioned before that we suspected it was going to be the more standalone-y episode.
Yeah.
And I think it's really interestingly positioned because it kind of has that feeling of that mid-series bump that we were talking about before, like the two-parter that hooks you in for the rest of the series because it gives you enough of a revelation about what's to come, or it's a returning villain. Obviously, it is a returning villain in the title as well, so that helps. But, I just thought that it did away with the Flux enough that you're looking forward to seeing what becomes of it like kind of later on.
Yeah.
But it still wasn't entirely divorced from that narrative. Obviously, you've still got all the stuff with Belle and Vinda and Neil from the Inbetweeners, and all that kind of stuff. Interesting that Azure and Passenger were the only two of that thruple to actually appear in the story.
Yeah, so what do you reckon that's all about? What do you think they're up to? I mean, obviously they're taking these people from different planets, but why? What's their end game with all that?
Do you think Azure's going into business for herself on that?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, we saw them use people as hostages, didn't we, in the previous story, in the past. Of course, yeah. So, I don't know. Is that...
It's interesting that we didn't see Swarm at all, you know?
No. Maybe he was busy. Maybe he was busy doing other naughty things elsewhere.
Devilish things with all the other passengers that were left behind.
Yeah.
I'm sure, you know, someone did that. Carvanista Dan fanfic. Somebody can do something with Swarm and Passenger, I'm sure.
Oh my god, yeah. Did you? That was
I saw the censored one.
Okay. I don't know what I saw. I saw too much, but whatever it was, too much. I didn't need to see it. And I don't think whoever decided to tag John's Bishop into it What a stupid bloody thing to do. What planet do you do that?
Moron. Ridiculous.
I really hope John Bishop didn't see that, because I know John Bishop's been enjoying all of Dr. Poop's hilarious videos.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, that is the side of fandom that you want him to see. Like, you want him to see the wholesome stuff and the funny stuff. I don't think we want John Bishop to see the smut side of things, because then he'll be like, oh dear, thank God it's only a one and done series for me. I couldn't cope with this for a few years.
Exactly. Run away from Twitter, John Bishop, before it gets any worse.
Yeah.
Where should we start, Matt? Should we start from the beginning? You're going to have to hold my hand through this one.
I'll hold your hand. So you've only seen it the once, haven't you?
Yes.
So I watched it twice, so I should know this story quite well. So we have the Doctor and co arriving in this village. Great start, because it felt like an old school Doctor Who. You have an old village with old fuddy-duddy peoples and like mad professors. That's brilliant. That's exactly what you want from a Doctor Who. And I think this is why this story worked so well, is because watching it, I kept thinking to myself, you could have any Doctor in this story and it would work. It didn't have to be Jodie. And I thought she was excellent. I thought she did a really, really good job. And again, I keep saying week on week, I'm enjoying her Doctor more each time. To the point now, I'm sort of thinking, oh, it is kind of a shame that she's going next year, because I feel like she's been given so much good material this year and so many moments to shine as the Doctor, where she may have not before. And it's just like, oh, it seems to be the curse. You know, we had the same trouble with Peter Capaldi. He found his feet and then he had to go, which is a real bummer. I thought the whole thing with the angels and Yaz and what's John Bishop called? Dan.
See?
We've had 4 weeks. I can't remember his name. Dan and Yaz going after that weeping angel, the scarecrow weeping angel, although it just turned out to be an angel. I was hoping it would be some sort of new twist on the angels. Ainley. Ainley, yeah. What am I doing in this story? That was really good. I think the directing for this episode was very impressive. It was very tense, the whole thing. It didn't really let up. I think the only time it sort of pause for a breather was when we had the scenes with Vinda and Belle doing their thing. But the whole thing, it grabbed you immediately.
And I really, standout moments for me, that scene, because you're right. I thought when you said the kind of respite might have been that scene on the beach between Claire, the angel, and the 13th Doctor. But actually, thinking about it, that the way that's set up and that whole thing, it kind of just makes you, it is a tense standoff, because it's obviously a standoff to a degree, but then obviously the mention of division and the revelations about division and the kind of wider implications for that, you know, reaching as far back as the planet of gold, you know, like, it's a really interesting, cool moment to have all of that stuff just unveiled to everybody, and for the first time it kind of felt like a flat sort of like, here's some division stuff finally, and they didn't kind of dance around it, you know, Jodie was able to react to something, or the 13th Doctor was able to react to something that actually felt like a bombshell. And obviously there's a much bigger bombshell later on, but from beginning to end, it was gripping.
Yeah.
And you're right, it didn't let go of you. It was the setting was fantastic. The little threads through it, like you said, the thing about the kind of classic Who thing, where you've got the older woman sort of like lingering around in the shadows.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, what's that about? And you could kind of see it a mile off.
Did you guess it was her? Did you guess it was a little girl? Yeah.
But by about her second appearance, I thought, well, we know that someone's going to get zapped back at some point. And we know that that girl's probably been zapped back because there's angels everywhere.
Yeah.
But what I didn't expect, and one of the coolest visuals of the whole thing, was that whole thing about the village being cut off by space.
Yeah.
It was just in this nowhere. And it was receding. And, you know, the village was kind of crumbling into this infinity. I just thought, I've always had phobias in like video games where you walk through a wall and you just fall through the infinite sort of blackness of it. And I was just like, man, that set off some deep triggers for me about that kind of thing.
I
loved it.
One thing that Flux is doing incredibly well is it's creating some great imagery for each story. Real good stuff that's really sticking out in people's minds. You know, I think with the Sontaran story, you know, the stuff like the spaceships in Liverpool Dock, and obviously the massive battle between the British and the Sontarans, which was amazing. Or, you know, Sontaran on a horse, you know, that's become a thing in and of itself. And then with this, like I said, you know, you've got that incredible image of the village hanging in space, which is an incredibly Doctor Who-y thing to do. And for me, it felt like something that you'd expect to see in a Doctor Who comic. Like this was like sort of almost kind of like Eighth Doctor era DWM comics, which I loved. I thought it was great. And, you know, the angels themselves tied into that because they got a lot of really great moments. Because I think with the angels, they almost feel like a bit of a one trick pony. Like a lot of Doctor Who monsters, you know, whenever they bring back a Doctor Who monster like the Autons or the Silurians, you always sort of think, well, what can you do with the Silurians that hasn't been done before, you know? And I think Maxine Alderton and Chibnall did a fantastic job. And I think she has really proven herself to be one of the great things about the most recent series of Doctor Who, because she did a fantastic job with the Cybermen last year with the Haunting of Villa Diodati. And now she's just proven herself again that she's like the go-to woman for a horror Doctor Who.
I think it was interesting there what you said about the Weeping Angels, that I think this episode kind of, and I know they've always been great and they've always been seen as sort of like the top 10 baddies of all time or whatever.
Yeah.
Or monsters. But I think this solidified them as being up there with Daleks, Cybermen, Sontarans, you know, Silurians, that kind of thing. Because, like you say, they are kind of a one-trick pony in that they've got a gimmick, but it could be tiresome after a while, you know? And, you know, all that don't blink. It's, you know, you're guaranteed if you press, you know, Control F on that script, there's going to be about 900 uses of the word blink. But the fact that they didn't feel like old hat in this, like I think that just proves that as a monster, as a concept, as a thing, they work so well that you can now have however many stories you like, and that's all they need to do, really. You know, obviously we've got some revelations about them and them as a species. I think I preferred the way that they communicated, that they used their voice in this.
Yeah.
You know, using Kevin McNally's character's voice back at him through the telly.
Yeah.
And, you know, Doctor Who sometimes does that thing where somebody doesn't have a character until they have some really long bit of dialogue that explains they're wounded or they're a bit hurt or there's something a bit cracked about them or they did something bad in their past.
Yeah.
And it's a line of dialogue and it can kind of feel a bit cheaty.
Yeah.
But I think it must be because it must be Kevin McNally, but also the script, that whole thing about Jericho, you know, trying to find answers in other things because you can't work yourself out, that kind of whole thing, was brilliant.
Yeah.
And added another layer of like real cynicism to the angels that they can break somebody down at a character level like that.
Yeah.
You know, it makes them less kind of boo jump scare monsters and more cerebral.
Yeah, there's a psychological element to them that, you know, we always sort of seen them in, I guess, in Time of Angels and whatever the second part of that story was called. You know, there was an element of that, but I think this story really exploited that for the benefit of the story. It was just, very well done. And I just like the way that, like you were saying, with Kevin McNally's character, you know, he could have just been, I'm a mad boffin type, which he was, but played incredibly well by Kevin McNally. He was excellent, a brilliant guest actor.
He's redeemed himself from...
He has.
I think maybe we have to get him on now.
Yeah. Well, to ask him if he actually did bite Nicola's bum.
Well, yeah, exactly. Maybe the arc is complete at that point.
Yeah. So, Yeah, and I liked that little line about, oh, you know, I was one of the first troops in Belsen, and nothing will ever compare to the horrors of what I saw there. So that was cool. I liked that. I liked that, you know, it just added a little extra something. You know, it didn't need to be there, but it just gave an extra layer to his character. I think another thing with the angels that was very good and sort of built on what we'd seen before was all of that stuff, that bit of lore that Moffat had developed for Matt Smith's first series of, you know, the image of an angel, that thing, which was utilized a lot this time round, but in very clever ways. You know, you had that, the one coming out of the TV.
The lie detector was so good.
Very clever.
It was one of those things where it gave you enough in the visual storytelling and the dialogue for you to go, oh no.
Yeah, you know where this is going.
What happened? You go, that's so good.
Yeah. And I loved that bit when it appeared out of the drawing and then the doctor sets it on fire. And then you've got that angel. And she's like, oh, made it worse. And it was like such a doctory moment to just be like, oh, that's quite a nonchalant way of talking about this terrible situation. And, you know, I just, she was just brilliant. There was so much of Jodie in this story that I just thought, oh, she's bloody doing brilliantly. And this, it was good to see.
Yeah, again, it's a sense of vindication that everybody is enjoying her as much as, you know, people who have enjoyed her at this level for the last two seasons of the program.
Yeah.
But you know, that it's not. I'm not blind to the fact that she is being given better stuff to do.
Yeah.
And I think, again, it's that whole thing. You stick her in a one-on-one confrontation with a villain, and if the villain's good, Jodie is going to sell that villain, because, you know, it's like the weight of the situation that she's facing. Because it did feel like a really weighty story, even though you didn't quite get the implications of course, Yaz and Dan being sent back in time.
Yeah,
you didn't quite get the implications of that. It's in 1901 they get sent back to. Until you don't really get the implication until the end, it still felt like it had that kind of earth shock, doom laden feel.
Yes.
There's going to be a big shift in something by the end of the episode. And obviously, you know, the big one being the Doctor has become an angel, has been recalled by Division.
Yeah.
And that Yaz and Dan and Kevin McNally's character, Jericho, and the little girl are stuck trapped in 1901.
It's 3 years, isn't it? Going by the next time trailer,
it's like, oh wow, the Doctor actually just wasn't able to help them.
No,
like, and they've kind of won. The angels have won.
Yeah,
you know, in that way, and that is why I think, for all we've complained about it in the past, not having everything told to you through trailers, through promotional materials, it's for moments like that where you think, Jesus, wow, right, okay. And it's the same with the cliffhangers.
Yeah.
You know, it's a properly brilliant Doctor Who moment that I think deservedly will be seen as one of the greatest cliffhangers.
For sure. I mean, even to the point where the BBC actually put a video out. I don't know if you saw that. Did you see the video that they put on Twitter of Jodie saying,
no,
oh, there's going to be some spoilers, you know, in this episode.
Oh, I did see that,
so,
yes.
Yeah, don't spoil it. Which is quite amusing after the week before, like, BBC Twitter put out a picture of Jo Martin lunchtime the next day, not even 24 hours after the episode had aired.
I know, and wasn't an independent article leaked?
Yes, yeah, it came out early. It was published early.
Yeah, I didn't catch it, thankfully.
No, nor me.
And I remember when I was having dinner, my phone went off, and I thought, I'm not going to look at it because it might be the Doctor Who Twitter account.
Yeah.
But it was you, and it was just all caps, do not go on Twitter.
That was it. Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
It was like, okay, yeah, right. So it's something big's gone down.
Yeah, because that was it. It was all over Twitter immediately. Like, people just can't help themselves. They can't keep their gob shut for whatever reason.
No. I mean, yeah, like, people know not to be on Twitter, though. You know,
that is true. Yeah, I mean, my phone is away whenever Doctor Who's on, you know, because invariably I never watch it as it's going out. Like we were sat down ready to watch it, and it was, you know, Mum was like, "Oh, I've just got to finish something." So I was like, "That's fine. Yeah. We'll just pause it and we'll just catch up as it, you know, as it happens." So yeah, I keep the phone away, keep away from Twitter. Obviously, it's a nuisance for people who aren't going to be watching it for, you know, maybe like the next day or something. That's more of a problem. But yeah, I think this series, you really, really need to be off of social media unless you're going to watch it when it goes out, sort of thing.
Didn't I see that you said on Twitter that you've got a theory about something in this episode?
I do. Go on. I do. It's a
do you want to put a fiver down on it?
I don't want to put a fiver down on it. It's not really a theory. It's just, okay, we'll talk about it now, seeing as we're talking about it. So obviously we have the cliffhanger that the Doctor becomes an angel, which was very good, very exciting. And we then are treated to a variation of the Doctor Who theme. Now, what was missing from that theme tune?
The bass line.
Yeah, the dum-de-dums. Now, what do we, you know, what, because of new series Doctor Who, what do we know that to mean?
Time Lord Heartbeat.
And of course, the Doctor has now become stone, so she no longer has a heartbeat.
Interesting.
And because when it happened, I was like, that's really cool and haunting. I was like, but there must be a reason why they've done that, or why Sagan has done that. And I thought, geez, I've just knocked all my microphone over. Gesticulating too much. The excitement. Yeah, I thought, well, it must be because she's petrified. She has no heartbeat. So it's just the ooey oos.
Very
we're getting.
Cool. What did you think about the bell bit cutting into the credits?
That annoyed me. I was a bit irked by that because I was like, you've just given us this. Because at first I thought, oh my God, there's something else. There's going to be another big reveal. And then I was disappointed. It was just,
I love you.
I've gone off to wherever, and the canals aren't here anymore. So I'll see you later, Vinder. Bye. I was annoyed.
Yeah, it did feel like quite a come down. It kind of felt like, you know, the reaction literally was, whoa, holy shit, oh my God. And then the credits, you go, whoa, what is going on? Then the crackle comes in. Whoa, oh my God, there's more. And then that scene, and then you're left kind of going, right, okay. Well, that cliffhanger was good, wasn't it? You know, but it kind of took the wind out of the sails. It kind of stole that moment. There's absolutely no reason why that bit couldn't have been, you know,
anywhere
directly
else.
After the last time we see Neil and bloody Belle on the planet.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I like Vinder. He's fine, and you know, I don't really have any sort of strong opinions about Belle, but I'm not really that fussed in what's going on with those two. Not enough for, you know, I thought having that little aside where we see all that stuff with Passenger and Azure, that was fine. I thought, okay, this is good. It breaks up the episode. This is our little moment to breathe. And it shows us that other things are going on in the wider narrative.
And it kind of gives you the Swarm Azure Passenger appearance for the episode without them interfering in the main plot. Yeah,
exactly. But then, I don't care enough for it to potentially damage one of the best Doctor Who cliffhangers we've had in, well, ever. It was just, a bit of a weird decision. You know, I could have happily have gone another week and not known that, you know, Vinder had turned up on that planet and found out that she'd buggered off somewhere else.
I feel weird about their storyline because it's obviously leading somewhere.
Yeah.
With you know, them reuniting, right? Yeah. But I like Vinder, you know, Belle seems like a cool character, but we haven't spent an awful lot of time with her in a setting that isn't her on her own, really. Yeah. You know, obviously we have our stuff with Neil from the Inbetweeners, but I don't think that when we had that, was it in the third episode, the end of the third episode, where we had that split screen and it was them in different parts. And I thought, okay, so that's what they did after their characters left the show. They went off and they looked for each other. And it's kind of a hopeful thing. It doesn't sort of, you know, tell you everything you need to know. But I was like, oh, that's a nice send-off for their characters. And I kind of feel like now we're just sort of treading water with them. It kind of feels like their bit's done, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I was saying this to someone else that, you know, they're obviously being kept around they're obviously being kept around for a reason.
Yeah.
And I really hope it is not the reason that you suggested, that they're the Doctor's mum and dad, because that would be fecking shite. I would not be happy.
Well, you know, maybe he's right again. Maybe he's wrong. We can but wait and see what happens.
So what do you think about the whole division thing, the revelations that the Weeping Angels, or some of the Weeping Angels, have worked for the division? Like, again, I feel like I've lost a grip on what the hell the division actually is, because last year it felt very much like, oh, okay, we're Time Lords, and we're like Time Lord Secret Service. That's what we are. Now, of course, we're being told, oh, well, the dog people, the Lupari, they're involved in some description. We've now got the Weeping Angels have been involved in some description. Oh, and now, again, oh, every planet, every race, blah, blah, blah. You know, what are they? What is going on? Are they from the past? Are they omnipresent?
That's an interesting take, isn't it? Like, I would take it to be that they are from the past, as you know, or they have been part of the past at some point, and that maybe they've been reactivated as like a cell or something. Because in my head, they're like a black ops for, you know, the CIA, Celestial Intervention Agency, and they've got their sort of like pockets of allies that help them. But it definitely feels like Time Lord dirty work. It definitely feels like this is who we send out to get stuff done so that we can make sure we're the only ones with time travel or whatever. And that whatever they do leads to their policy of non-interference because they do something really terrible. And that everybody knows the secrets of the Time Lords, but they also know they're almighty and all-powerful. And if anybody tried to leak those secrets, you know, they wouldn't last long. So, you know, the division is some sort of like, not literally MK Ultra, but it has that same kind of like, every, you know, redacted sort of part of Time Lord history. And maybe rather than scrubbing stuff out in a black pen, like with a document in that kind of redacted thing, you redact them from time or, you know, you something like that. But I know what you mean, that it feels a bit nebulous, but that's only because we are being drip-fed stuff still, you know, about the division.
Do you think we might find out more this week? Because obviously they kept Jodie's appearance in this, the Next Time trailer, purely to, she's a statue. I know some people were sort of saying, oh, do you think this will be like a Dr. Light story? Which I really hope it isn't, because, you know, we haven't got many episodes left with Jodie, so I'd like to see as much of her as we possibly can. Do you think they're just keeping it quiet? Do you think she'll end up on planet whatever and then she'll be unstatued and be given a PowerPoint presentation about what the division is and we'll actually learn some stuff?
I could see her not being in next week's at all.
Do you reckon?
I could see her not doing anything until maybe like midway through the last episode, where she's finally sort of like freed or whatever. And then she gets to do her like big speech about, I've actually worked out what all this is and I know how to stop you, sort of thing.
Yeah.
I could see that happening, because we don't really know how much of this week's upcoming story, how much of that has to do with all the stuff we've seen on the wires in that sort of temple sort of spot. Yeah. Kevin McNally's character is obviously back in it again this week. And we've got Williamson back in it. So I would assume they're in his tunnels from the promo photos that we've seen. I think we'll get the answer to that this week. I don't think we'll get the answer to the division.
Yeah.
And I don't expect Jodie to be in it an awful lot, to be honest.
Okay.
I think division will be saved for the final story.
Okay.
And that is because, you know, they have been very pointed in mentioning the Doctor's past lives and knowing about them and giving you your memories back and all that kind of stuff. I think the amount of times that's been mentioned, how central it was to the third episode, and obviously in the conversation that the Doctor had with the Angel, I think really that has to be resolved in episode six.
Yeah. Before we talk any more about what we expect further, one thing we haven't mentioned is the character of Claire in this story.
Yeah.
Some people seem to be a bit confused because she was like, oh, you know, she found the Doctor and Yaz in the 21st century, as we saw in the first episode.
Yeah.
And she knew who the Doctor was. She knew who Yaz was and what the TARDIS was and all this kind of stuff. And some people are confused. We're like, well, how does she know that? How does she know that? But I think that was sort of made fairly clear because the idea is that she is clairvoyant, isn't she?
Mm.
And her name's Claire. She's Claire the clairvoyant.
So I
think she just had a premonition of, oh, I'm going to, there's this woman, this stuff is going to happen. This is the Doctor. This is, I mean, for all we know, it could have been the Angel sending that message to her.
Well, I kind of assumed that she didn't pick up on all of that herself. And I think maybe that she would even admit that she didn't pick it. Yeah, it's like I got a message through.
Yeah.
And I got Doctor, this street, this day, this time, that kind of thing. And she lists them out, doesn't she?
Yes.
God, I can't believe I remembered that. I'm really struggling to remember things about the story. That's not to say I didn't enjoy it because I thought it was fabulous, obviously. But I would have thought it was pretty obvious what the deal was there.
I think sometimes people, because obviously this series in particular has been quite confusing and, you know, I hate to use the term timey-wimey. I think people are trying to second guess things that don't need second guessing, like, oh, but you know, there must be another level. I mean, maybe there is, maybe I'm talking out my ass, but I think it was just
on the flip reverse of that, you're also getting people saying this story is told badly, and it's like it's not finished yet. It's not done.
No.
Like you don't get halfway through a book and go, I've decided the rest of this whole book is rubbish.
Yeah.
Because I don't, you know, like people are weird, man.
Let's take a story like Kinder, for instance. If you just watch episode one of Kinder in isolation, you're not going to go, oh, well, this story's crap because, you know, nothing makes sense. Well, no, of course it doesn't make sense. You haven't watched the other three 25-minute episodes. That's bonkers. But, you know, people just feel a need to complain about anything and everything these days. But I loved all that stuff with Claire's character, the psychic experiments. You know, that was a very strong opening to the story with her undergoing those experiments. And, you know, the possession idea.
Yeah.
The pupils expanding and all that sort of stuff. And I loved all that. The actress playing her part was incredibly good at differentiating Claire and the voice of the Angel. Like, even on that scene on the beach, you know, I don't know if they did a slight bit of modulation, but it felt very much like she had lowered her own register.
I think it had been slightly modulated. Yeah. But all that whole sequence, I think it was very comfort viewing, even though it was obviously very tense, that whole thing with the Angels breaking into the house.
Yeah.
Because it kind of, it's a base under siege.
Yeah.
They're trapped in a very small space.
Yeah.
And there's things outside trying to get in to kill them. And, you know, with the TV on as well and all that sort of stuff, it was dripping in that kind of like creepy, the monster's coming to get you atmosphere. And all of their attempts to try and get in and get at them and get kind of in their heads and mess with them.
Yeah.
I think that is the thing, you know, that this episode has provided. You know, Stephen Moffat gave the Weeping Angels the ability to, you know, turn the bloody Statue of Liberty into a walking, talking, you know, Weeping Angel. Exactly. That's very big and grandiose and, you know, sure, it's cool visual. But actually, and I'm not saying that Stephen Moffat hadn't originated this, but this whole getting in your head and making you want to turn away,
yeah,
and, you know, that's really creepy. That's really dark. It's kind of like you're making somebody seal their own fate. Like, you know you can't last through this. So let's get this over with.
Because with Moffat, it was the Angel Bob thing, wasn't it? Oh, Angel Bob, because, oh, we've pulled out this guy's larynx or whatever, and we're using his voice, which is cool, and that's scary. But somehow I think having Kevin McNally, you know, whose voice just, you know, again, he managed to shift the tone of his voice in such a way to make him sound so much more menacing. And, you know, he was dripping with evil. And, you know, the idea that they can just adopt someone's voice and, like you said, really get into their heads is scarier, somehow scarier than, oh, we tore out someone's throat and, you know, fiddled around with his vocal cords or whatever. But it really did feel like Chibnall and Alderton like really just threw everything at this story, every bit of Weeping Angel lore that they had. It was just like, right, okay, so we're gonna have the woman becoming an angel, like with Amy Pond, but done incredibly well. That whole sequence in the bathroom when she first sees the wings was incredibly well done. Did you see the behind the scenes on how they shot that?
No, I didn't. No.
So they actually, so she obviously looks in the mirror, doesn't she? And she looks up. So they had, the mirror was just completely cut out. So they had the bathroom made twice, and they had a double for the back of Claire's head. And then they had the reflection of Claire was actually Claire just stood in front of it. So it was done that way. So it was all mirrored just via performance. Very clever and really effective. Impressive. Yeah. And it felt, you know, it felt like like an old 70s horror film.
I was thinking, you know, everybody's going to expect her to look up, because that, you know, that is a creepy thing. It's an uncomfortable thing when you go into the bathroom and brush your teeth and you look in the mirror. It's like, I know something is going to be stood behind me, growling at me, you know, whatever.
Yeah, we all expected an angel to be behind her.
Exactly. But actually, for the wings to be there was like a whole, like, whoa, okay.
Yeah.
And the angel dust getting into her eye, I thought was quite interesting as well. When they were in the catacombs afterwards, and she looks up, and you've got that great shot where it comes right down. All the stuff where she's trying to hide becoming an angel from the doctor.
Yeah.
You know, brushing things away. That was really cool. It's made them a potent threat again, I think, rather than being, they're the one that gets you when you're not looking at them.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, they do, but it's more like, you can't just have that as a story.
No.
You know, they if you put the Weeping Angels in a framework where they need to get you, or, yeah, like, there is this whole other aspect of there's a rogue angel and blah, blah, blah. It just goes to show you can do loads of stuff with them.
Yeah.
And I think this is the first step in sort of, again, kind of making them this century's original big bad, you know?
Yeah, it gives them more personality, because I think when you take a story like Blink, they almost feel kind of like a monster like the Autons, that there's not much personality there. They are scary because they look unpleasant and they move unpleasantly, and, you know, they have their gimmick. Whereas Time of Angels, and then this one is particularly, really built on them actually having a character, and, you know, the idea that they might work for somebody else. What I like about it is that they don't go into too much detail, because you never want to see too much of them, because we don't want to know that, oh, they've got a bloody society and all this sort of stuff. Maybe hint that there is something there, but you don't want to see that, because otherwise then you're just like, okay. That sort of would undermine them a little bit. But
so what do you make of the whole their part of division, and I guess we'll talk about the ending, I guess, and what it means for everything else.
Well, I mean, they're described, aren't they, as the Quantum Assassins, or whatever the Tenth Doctor refers to them as in Blink. So they probably were just used by Division to be like, right, well, you're our assassination squad, like you were saying about taking people out of time. It's like, well, who else better to do it than get the angels to do it?
And also, as far as the Time Lords are concerned, it's like, well, no blood on our hands, because they kill people. So
no, there's no paper trail. There's nothing like that. You know, the angels get something out of it. You know, they get fed. They get exactly what they need. And I like the idea that, you know, the angels actually do kill people. You know, if you get caught twice.
If you touch them twice, that's a really cool addition.
Yeah, that was great. That was a really cool moment. Speaking of which, There was another Doctor Who alumni in this story.
Go on.
So the old man, the miserable old git looking for Peggy.
Yeah.
He was previously in a Peter Davison story.
Right.
Can you guess which?
Matt, you're gonna have to do it. Just tell me.
He played one of the Silurian triads in Warriors of the Deep.
My God, everybody's getting their second go round, aren't they?
Yeah.
They've given me something good to do.
Yeah, yeah. So I think I don't think he was necessarily the main one, but I think he might have been one of the other two. Yeah, so he was a
Tarpok.
Yes. Oh no, maybe he was Tarpok. Is that the main one?
Oh, okay.
I don't like that story, so you know, not particularly. They cocked up the Silurians and the Sea Devils with their bucket heads.
Yeah.
But
oh well, never mind. We move on.
He can finally say, I was in Doctor Who, and you can actually see me in Doctor Who. I'm not under a rubber mask with a wobbly
head.
And
it was a good one. It's one that people don't ridicule.
Yeah.
So he's
singularly gone from being in like one of the most derided stories ever with the bloody Murker to being in probably one of the best.
There we go. That's a pretty good exchange, isn't it?
Yeah.
So obviously, cliffhanger, Jodie's an angel. This visual where they kind of, it looks like they're forming angel wings from that kind of top position. That was really cool. So what happens now? What's going to happen, Matt?
I don't know. You saw like a planet, didn't we? Hanging in space at the end. Like, is that some sort of division planet? Is that where they've taken the Doctor? Obviously, like you said, you know, Yaz and Dan and what's his name? Jericho. You know, they're all stuck in the past for at least 3 years. I think you're probably right. I think you're right in saying that it's probably that guy's tunnels. You know, they've tried to find a way of locating that or whatever.
Because the costume that Yaz is wearing, there was some photos taken by location spotters in Liverpool of Kevin McNally and I think John Bishop, but definitely Amanda Gill, coming down the steps of Liverpool Town Hall, I think it was.
Right.
And they're in those costumes.
Yeah.
So maybe they've managed to like hitchhike their way up to Liverpool.
Yeah.
And they, you know, because, yeah, I guess, but Dan's met Williamson. I don't think Dan knows who he is.
No.
But Dan has been in the tunnels.
Yeah.
Dan knows Williamson. Perhaps whatever Williamson was being chased by in the tunnels in that segment, we'll see what that was in this one.
Yeah, maybe.
Because it's the same set design for that tunnel network.
Yeah.
As we saw in that story in Once Upon Time.
Yeah, and we said it's, you know, they clearly made a point of keeping it secret.
Yeah, exactly. And the Ood are back.
Got the Ood next week, yeah.
Got the Ood next week, that's cool. Yeah. And Swarm's back in his glorious self.
Yeah. The Grand Serpent is back.
The Black Serpent. So I'm. What do we think is going on there? Is this another division agent? Is this?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Like, what would bring him to Earth in the 21st century? And obviously, Carvanista's back as well, and he makes a point in the trailer of saying that the shield around Earth is compromised.
Yeah.
So obviously, the jeopardy level has risen. Interesting. I don't understand how he is going to come into the story, because his whole thing, the Grand Serpent's whole thing, felt so insular to that one. Yeah, to that one story. You know, that little segment. So, yeah, I'm very interested because he's with the TARDIS, isn't he? The TARDIS is in the present. So has the TARDIS just been stuck in that village?
And the whole time.
You know, it was picked up. Because they said, didn't they? The army came in. The army came in and took over the village. So, you know, did the army come in? TARDIS goes into mothballs. Unit come along. Yeah. Oh, that's a TARDIS. What's going on here?
Maybe the people that move in are like a precursor to Unit or something.
Yeah.
And so Stuart has been sitting on that box since then. Like, it's been put in the Black Archive or something. that would be interesting. Really cool to see Kate back. I'm looking forward to seeing Kate Stewart and UNIT as a whole back in the story next week.
I hope they can do something with her, because I find, and this is no offence to Redgrave's at all, you know, I just find the character quite dull. I just don't, she doesn't have much character. Her character is, she's the Brigadier's daughter. And it felt like she was in Stephen Moffat's Doctor Who stories. Every episode, every time she appeared, it was like, oh, your father, you know, your father, the Brigadier, you know, your dad, the Brigadier.
Yeah,
that
I know.
Really good character that everybody loved. Yeah, your dad.
You're not him.
You're not him, but remember, what would he do? What would your dad do?
I think that does suck, because it's like a constant comparison to him, and it's like, well, she should be able to stand up as a character in her own right, you know?
Yeah, I think you needed that in that first episode to say, oh yeah, I'm the Brigadier's daughter, and be like, oh, that's nice, and then leave it then. You don't need the bloody plane to have Nicholas Courtney's bloody picture on it. This is like, okay, yeah, that's sweet, but you know, most people at home are not going to know who that is or why it's there.
And you undo all of that lovely sentiment anyway by showing him as a corpse in a Cyberman suit.
We pretend that didn't happen. Hopefully, maybe the Flux will rewrite that.
Maybe. We can only hope. Maybe the Flux is there to like go like to the next showrunner. Like, here you go. It's a brand new cosmos for you to play in.
Yeah, well, it could be. It could be like a reset button. Who knows?
Yeah, my God. Really exciting stuff, though. And I'm glad that we had this episode as a sort of a standalone, because I think as great as the other episodes have been, you know, the Flux obviously loomed large over the whole plot. And it was nice to have a story where you weren't thinking so much about the Flux, but all of the stuff that has come out as a response to the Flux, that reared its head in nice little ways just to keep you tied in with the plot. And don't worry, it's still going, but in the meantime, here's this really great Weeping Angel story. And shock horror, it's not kind of the end of them in the series at all, because the Doctor is one now. So really, really cool. I'm really excited to see where they go with it.
Well, I think for the finale, the Vanquishers, I think the cast list has been revealed, and I'm pretty sure the Sontarans, the Cybermen, the Daleks, I'm sure they were all mentioned on the cast list. So, you know, I think we said last week, do we think that the finale is going to be one of those things where everyone who's everyone is going to be in it, even if it's just as a little aside? You know, I don't expect to see much from the Daleks or the Cybermen.
Yeah.
But it's just there to reaffirm that this is affecting everyone, even the big players, which is really cool. So I think that's probably all we have to say on Village of the Angels. It was fantastic. And I think everybody really enjoyed it. I don't think I've seen anybody sort of say that it was crap.
I've seen a few moans, but you know, obviously that's par for the course with any TV program. You know, but they've not been moans that are kind of like, oh, you're just disliking it for the sake of disliking it. A lot of people sort of saying, I don't quite get the hype. And that's you know, obviously that's more than fair enough. But we've both really enjoyed it. And it's just another great story in this great season. So and I actually have a lot more hope for the next two stories to actually effectively wrap things up, because I feel like we're moving in a direction now where that has to start happening.
Yes.
And I have faith that that will happen in the next two stories.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think something that I said to someone on Twitter was my concern with this whole thing is that this was a fantastic story, but will this end up a bit like the Stephen Moffat stuff? Will it be like, we get, you know, the season ends and we go, oh, when we go back and watch The Village of the Angels, we're going to love it, and then go, The Division, that didn't come to anything, or that didn't work out well.
That's always the fear, isn't it? But I think we just have to go along on, you know, I'm sure some people don't have good faith in it to be in it being resolved, either because they've had their, you know, they've had that happen before with Stephen Moffat, or they don't have faith in Chris Chibnall to do it himself. But I have faith at the moment. I have faith. And I think I have more faith coming off the back of that last story. Because I think it's paced itself well in its reveals.
Yeah.
And I think if it continues on that path of pacing it the way that they have, I think we should have a really satisfying conclusion by the end.
Yeah, I hope they've learnt from the Timeless Children and you know, not to just go, here is an info dump.
In the last episode.
In the last episode. I hope they can drip feed it. So I guess my final question for you is, Weeping Angel stories, how do you rank them? Now that we've had, what, four?
This at the top.
Yeah.
Blink, Matt Smith two-parter, and then probably, the Angels in Manhattan.
Okay, I kind of agree with you. I'd say Village of Angels, then I'd say Time of Angels, the Matt Smith one, then Blink, and then we can leave Angels Take Manhattan for the bin. Maybe that's one we should do at some point, Angels Take Manhattan. Because I think it was Josh from Who Knew podcast was like, what's wrong with Angels Take Manhattan? That's a good story. So maybe we should talk about that at some point in the future.
I think we're not done with the Matt Smith era.
No, not by a long shot.
More we need to look at there. So maybe we'll look to do that. Yeah,
in the new year at some point.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Well, thank you as ever, Billy. Thank you for joining me in isolation land the studio.
It's a pleasure as always, my friend.
I'm sorry
to you, obviously, and obviously to people listening that you're not seeing us in our usual nice plush setup.
I tried to point the camera in such a way that you had a bit of a Doctor Who-y background for those watching on YouTube, and obviously, Billy, you've got a TARDIS and a Dalek, and the Beatles have been in Doctor Who occasionally, so you know,
there we go.
You've got enough references there. So
that's all the connections you're going to get. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you all for listening. I can't talk. Thank you all for listening and watching. And we shall see you next time for The Survivors of the Flux.
Bye.
Bye-bye.